I know I'm a minister, but some days it's really hard to be a religious person. When I say religious, I mean that I practice my Unitarian Universalism as best I can. I try to live by our principles. I try to love my neighbor as I would love myself. And although perhaps somewhat naive, I have faith that there is goodness and love in the world, and in the end that will prevail. I also know that we people have our flaws. And when you involve human beings in any system or structure, there will be plenty of flaws. Organized religions do have some flaws, for they have human beings leading and participating in them. Sometimes the flaws seem so apparent that it's tempting to name a few. I could talk about religious movements being on the wrong side of so many things. Of course, what I mean by the wrong side could and would be debated by others, so I will not make a long list. Just a short little one. I think churches that collect millions and millions of dollars and have their pastors fly around in private jets and live in multi-million dollar homes is wrong. I think that hiding and protecting clergy that prey on children is wrong. I think that interpretations of religious doctrine that treat women as anything other than true and equal members of society is wrong. And of course, I believe that many religious communities are wrong that refuse to acknowledge the rights of those who love each other to marry. This is a very small list. I could add many things to this list, and I believe many of us could. But this might be expected, for religions are run and interpreted by humans, and we humans have flaws. We see things differently from one another, and we struggle sometimes with mutual agreement on things like justice or mercy or equality or grace. This all brings up some mighty interesting subjects that could be discussed when you have as a monthly worship theme the concept of religious authority. There's a lot that could be examined in the concept of religious authority. One of the main questions is, why do religions have authority? And where do they think it comes from? This is certainly sermon fodder. But today I'm talking about another aspect of authority, not where it comes from, but this question. Do religions speak from a place of authority when the time comes for revolutions of change? A couple of weeks ago I said that it was a place for religious communities to lift up for discussion and examination major themes such as brokenness, forgiveness, reconciliation, mending, healing, wholeness, love, peace, and transformation, just to name a few. I think religious communities are unique places in society where these themes are discussed. Now, understanding that these communities are flawed by virtue of their human interpretation of doctrines, beliefs, or principles, the question remains, are these not important themes to discuss and examine? And yes, I believe they are. With all the flaws of religion, I do think that a religious perspective is vital to revolutions, especially revolutions that want to be nonviolent. I think that a big part of the struggle for humanity, when tensions reach a point of conflict, is to resist the temptation to focus completely on the people who wage wars rather than the problems that cause war. I'm going to read that again. I think that a big part of the struggle for humanity, when tensions reach a point of conflict, is to resist the temptation to focus completely on the people who wage wars rather than the problems that cause war. In her book After Empire, The Art and Ethos of Enduring Peace, Sharon Welch, who is a professor at our Meadville Lombard School Seminary in Chicago, cites Thich Nhat Hanh when she writes that our enemy is not the other person. Our enemy is the violence, ignorance, and injustice in us and in the other person. Her words sing out for the needs of alternatives to cycles of violence that include revenge and retribution. And I believe that being aware of and breaking these cycles can be a vital role for the voices of people of faith in nonviolent revolutions of change. This can be true even though much violence, death, and destruction has been done in the name of religion. It is another list that could be easily made that would include things such as the Crusades and September 11th, 2001. We can't and shouldn't hide these things. They must be acknowledged as a byproduct of fanaticism, fundamentalism, and in some cases, literalism. This is where human flaws come into play and why we must not let the world succumb to this kind of interpretation or behavior. But painting all religions and all religious practice or beliefs as bad based on the Crusades is like claiming that democracy is a failed system based on our current Congress. Oh, wait, maybe I shouldn't give that example. Well, you know what I mean. There are many elements of many faiths that call for peace and justice as a core tenet of their faith. Many faiths have moral belief systems that tell them the time has come to take new risks in promoting peace and justice. According to Avizur Revitsky, the author of The Concept of Shalom in Traditional Jewish Sources, the rabbinic text, the Jewish rabbinic text, Concept of Shalom, primarily signifies a value and ethical category. It denotes the overcoming of strife, quarrel, and social tension, and the prevention of hostility and war. This concept, although still steeped in religious tradition and depicted as a blessing, a manifestation of divine grace, is also, however, thought to be a part of a normative moral belief system which believes that the pursuit of peace is the obligation of the individual. The pursuit of peace is the obligation of the individual. In addition to peace and nonviolence, communities of faith can have authority in both concepts and deeds around change brought to bear through actions of social justice. Virtually all major faiths, especially those traditionally practiced in the United States, have deeply held views on the need for social justice. The Interfaith Committee on Worker Justice points out that the Jewish Bible includes dozens of laws covering economic and social ethics and actions. Catholics have a long history of social justice teachings, including papal announcements and social action movements led by church reformers such as Dorothy Day. Virtually all Protestant denominations have similar teachings in their founding documents and as well as recent resolutions. And Islam, now the third largest faith in the United States, includes broad social justice precepts and guidelines in the Quran. The Buddhist, Hindu, and Native American religious communities also espouse principles of justice and community. These precedents, these teachings and deeds have helped to support historical struggles to overcome our own flaws. To overcome our own flaws. And this has never been easy and continues to be a long and difficult struggle. Communities of faith and their religious concepts have been at the foundation of these struggles and have helped support nonviolent revolutions of change, especially when there is a need for planning and a long-term commitment. This was a clear lesson of the civil rights movement in the United States and Gandhi's movement in India. These movements set long-term goals that were strategically planned and implemented. In part, King's training ground was the Highlander Center, where he trained in strategies of nonviolent direct action. Gandhi, coincidentally, spent a good deal of time practicing and formulating his theories and practices in South Africa as a young man. Walter Wink, my favorite theologian, somebody came up to me last week and asked me about Walter Wink, has taught me much about nonviolence. Frequently using King and Gandhi as examples, he observes that nonviolent revolutions never happen by accident. They are the outcome of grassroots training, discipline, organizing, and hard work. And revolutions, especially revolutions of love, call for a commitment to the greater good and what some might call a higher self. In his Christian context, Wink highlights his theological justification when he talks about Jesus' concept of sacrifice from Luke 17:33. When Jesus said, "Those who try to make their life secure will lose it, but those who lose their life will keep it," Wink says he drew a line in the sand and asked if we would step across. Step out of one entire world where violence is always the ultimate solution into another world where the spiral of violence is finally broken by those willing to absorb it with their own flesh. This new approach to living, he says, is nonviolence. Wink's words are worth repeating. Step out of one entire world where violence is always the ultimate solution into another world where the spiral of violence is finally broken by those willing to absorb it with their own flesh. This is a huge commitment, and not an easy one to make in an angry world. Again, Wink acknowledges this when he says, "This is a tall task to ask a group of oppressed people, especially when they've suffered the deep wounds that come from physical, fiscal, emotional, and spiritual oppression." He points out how important this was to Dr. King in the civil rights struggle. I think about what oppressed people have had to deal with, and then to ask them to hold nonviolence in their hearts and heads through incredibly hard days of movements of change is almost beyond asking. I do not consider myself an oppressed person, and I find this call to loving thy neighbor and supporting the change I want to see in the world through nonviolent action and speech hard enough. When my enemy is the noisy neighbor, the person who scratches my car, or the rude sales clerk. I also know that this is a challenge for those who now face police action at the Occupy movements across the country. If I were a Christian, I think I would have to agree with Wink when he says that for Christians, at least, the ultimate religious question of our time is no longer the Reformation's "How do I find a gracious God?" It is instead, "How can I find God in my enemies?" He also lifts up something that I deeply believe in now more than ever, which is being an example of love and revolutions of change is in our own self-interest. It is a necessary element of our engagement in the nonviolent process. He says, "It is my own self-interest to recognize that my opponents have jobs or mortgages that tie them to the existing political and economic system. They too are afraid of losing their grip on the world. They need to be reassured that the revolution will not strip them of all means of making a living or all that hard-won security." Gandhi used this point in his reasoning that revolutions of love have to be about fundamental justice. Fundamental justice has been a theme of nonviolent movements in history, and perhaps a significant difference from movements of violent struggle. That is, the difference between the need for victory at any cost and the desire for victory based on fundamental rights and justice. Perhaps a colleague of Dr. King, the Reverend James Bevel, said it best when talking about a situation that called for the need of love of one's enemies. He said, "We're not just fighting for our rights, but for the good of the whole society." What leads us back to the need for spiritual support and centering is this. Fighting for anything can take its toll and calls for the deepest soul searching possible. Resistance to the powers or forces resistant to change in the world can take its toll emotionally, physically, mentally, and certainly spiritually. To avoid being turned into what one is fighting, there needs to be a commitment to doing the inner work necessary to stay spiritually fit. There needs to be an element of humility, reflection, and self-understanding when you are fighting the flaws in the world, lest we fall into the flaw of self-righteousness. Wink says it this way. In such a mood, it is easy to fall into the us-them thinking, to forget our own complicity in it, or past complicity toward the evil we now so tardily and always seem tardily to oppose. I wonder if the Occupy movement would be so strong if the dot-com boom hadn't busted. Wink feels that this potential for evil, or to reflect the darkness of the oppressor, is something that is in all of us. It is something that is difficult to admit, but an essential component of resisting the shadow side of what we are trying to change. I agree with the statement that people who engage in nonviolent protest without at least some awareness of this cesspool of violence within them can actually jeopardize the lives of their compatriots. I have often thought this while watching peace rallies turn into angry and violent rhetoric and mob-like behaviors. But Wink is firm about pointing out that violence is not always avoidable. He puts this into context through a statement that I feel highlights the struggle with the violence-nonviolence question when he offers, "Violence is not an absolute evil to be avoided at all costs. It is not even the main problem, but only the presenting symptom of an unjust society. And peace is not the highest good. It is rather the outcome of a just order. Violence has been and will always be a tool of the angry or the oppressed, a wake-up call, and or some other form of societal upheaval. It is never something that should be celebrated, but in many cases in history, it has to be understood. The key here is that we have a choice how we act. We have a choice how we act in the face of violence and the oppression of ourselves or others. And although this choice can be enormously difficult, we still have a choice. We do have a choice. For change is at our door. It seems like all generations have these choices to make, as stated by this voice from over 50 years ago who said, "I think the American people expect more from us than cries of indignation and attack. The times are too grave, the challenge too urgent, and the stakes too high to permit the customary passions of political debate. We are not here to curse the darkness, but to light a candle that can guide us through that darkness to a safe and sane future." Words spoken by John Fitzgerald Kennedy at his Democratic nomination acceptance speech, July 15, 1960. Revolutions of change are in the air, and we must decide as people of faith, are we here to curse the darkness or help light the candle that will light the way to a safe and sane future where peace is the outcome of a just and compassionate society? So today I pray, may we stay centered in our faith. May we stay nonviolent in our actions. May we reflect on our complicity in systems of inequality and oppression. And may the light of peace and love illuminate a path for a better future for us all. Amen.